Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books and Political Science, a podcast by the New Books Network. I'm Doha Jirbi, a PhD student in political science at the Geneva Graduate Institute. With me today is Professor Carla Hummel of the University of Miami to discuss their book, Why Informal Workers Organize, Contentious Politics, Enforcement, and the State. In this book, published in 2021 by Oxford University Press, Dr. Hummel marshals a variety of methodological techniques, from original surveys, machine learning estimations, to 14 months of ethnographic fieldwork in Bolivia and Brazil, to answer the questions of why and under what conditions groups like street vendors decide to organize. Specifically, Dr. Hummel shows how workers and what Z calls officials, the assembly of local politicians, bureaucrats, and police, interact to co-produce organization and compliance. With a game theoretic model underpinning a strong theory of strategic state intervention and collective action, which builds off of and advances canon works in collective action literature, this book is especially useful for those researching contentious politics, civil society, and informal economies, as well as labor ethnographers, sociologists of work, and public policy practitioners. This brief introduction does not give justice to this excellent book, winner of the 2023 Riker Prize for the Best Book in Political Economy. So Carla, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in informal economies.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I'm very excited to be here and to discuss my book. I started to be interested in informal economies and especially how people working in informal economies organize when I was working under the table in the 2008, after the 2008 financial crisis in the US. So I graduated, I couldn't get a job, and I took a bunch of essentially gig work around Seattle. And I later then started traveling to Bolivia. And in Bolivia, lots of people work informally. About 80% of people in Bolivia work informally. But unlike in the United States, many of them belong to associations and unions. So where I was experiencing a financial and political crisis in the United States and just kind of getting whatever job would give me a little bit of cash and being relatively atomized from political processes and absolutely not organized in any sense, the people that I was meeting in Bolivia who had gone through similar things were joining unions and talking to local politicians and protesting and being very much mobilized as workers. And so I thought this was really, really interesting, just on a personal level. Like, I wanted to know how workers in the United States could do something similar to what workers in Bolivia had been doing through a variety of different political conditions. And from a political science perspective, I also realized that this was really not what political scientists would expect. Political scientists would expect that people who work informally don't organize, don't engage in politics, are pretty atomized because people who work informally lack a lot of the things that we associate with unionization and with political participation more broadly. People are typically working long hours for little pay, and they're also breaking all of these laws. And so political scientists don't expect people who don't have very many resources and are breaking a lot of laws to intentionally engage with the political system. But we see that in Bolivia. And so it was a really interesting puzzle to work on, as well as something personally meaningful, because I wanted to see this kind of level of worker mobilization in the United States.
That's great. I really love to learn about the genesis of an author's sort of idea and having it tied to their personal experience, especially in precarious labor, like yours, is really interesting. And yeah, in your book, you do say that this is sort of an important contribution to this, because people always assume, and researchers in particular, that informal workers rarely organize, which you show is not at all the case. But another justification for your intervention, which I also found extremely interesting, is that a lot of the collective action literature tends to sideline a pretty big player, the government. I haven't read your book, and I find that incorporating the state and its associated actors in such analyses seems rather intuitive. So why do you think that there is this sidelining of the government?
So I think this just has to do with the academic cycles that we see. So when Ostrom and Olson were writing, the assumption was that the state was this really big player who could influence things. And the conventional wisdom was that these large players like the state were the entities that would solve collective action problems. And then because of that, people got really, really interested in the 80s in how people solve collective action problems without any kind of state intervention. And then we kind of just forgot about the state. there wasn't much of a point where within these collective action theory discussions, the state then kind of like came back in a big way. The state's definitely in some things, like Ostrom discusses the state and local politics, especially in many of her books. But the state doesn't become this big player again the way that that it was kind of assumed to be, but not fully theorized as earlier on. And I also think that in my work and in the book, the role that the state is playing is particularly novel and interesting, where it's not just like the state as this large monolith that can compel people to do things. It's these people that work within the state who have these very specific incentives to get some kind of compliance out of these, out of informal workers and out of the informal sector in general, who are then coming up with all of these incentives to try to get people to organize. And that relationship is not something, at least I haven't seen it in other literature in the collective action fields.
I see. And yeah, and I think this focus on the state is particularly important, and I think it shines through in the two cases that you've zeroed in. Zeroed on. So like you have Brazil and Bolivia, and you do in the book, you have a very detailed explanation and justification for your case selection. But for the benefit of our listeners, can you just tell us a little bit more about first the choice to focus on Latin America, and second, these two countries that you ended up selecting? So why, yeah, how did you come to that decision?
Yeah, so it goes less to a focus on Latin America and more a focus on Bolivia specifically. So in the area of informal work and the informal sector, Bolivia is one of the places in the world with the highest levels of informality. So when we have different rankings of informality, either by size of GDP or how many people work informally, Bolivia is always at the top or number two or tied to the top. And so Bolivia is a really interesting case to look at informal work and informal dynamics. And then more broadly, as a political scientist, there's lots of things that happen in Bolivia that either don't happen in other places or don't happen to the extent that they do in Bolivia. And so Bolivia always has lots of really, really interesting theoretical puzzles to look at from a political science theory standpoint. And so that's how I got into Bolivia, was just seeing all these different things. And whenever I'm in Bolivia, there's this constant thing of like, why is that happening? Why is that happening? This goes against expectations. This goes against theory. Why are we seeing this? Why are we seeing that? And so Bolivia is always supplying a lot of really interesting research questions. Brazil then is, so Bolivia is like the extreme case where the dynamics are really clear. Gehring, Seawright call this a pathway case where we see everything work in these really stark terms. And then Brazil is another pathway case, but basically Brazil's kind of the average. Brazil's what usually happens. And so levels of informality in Brazil are around the average for Latin America and around the average for the Global South too, where there's about 40% of people are working informally and 20 to 30% of GDP comes from informal work. So we see some similar dynamics, but they're not as dark or extreme as we see in Bolivia. And political scientists will say, but we should not be selecting on the dependent variable, and this is all selecting on the dependent variable.
Right.
There are several things in the book where, like, I select other cases within those countries on the independent variable, and then also for just the initial case selection, the initial part of the project was very much theory development. Totally fine to select on the dependent variable for theory development, and then you test with new external data, which I did through the quantitative work that looks at data from across Latin America and across the world, actually. So there's plenty of things in the book where I start from an independent variable standpoint or test parts of the theory on new data. It's not just a dependent variable story.
Okay, but even if it was, I think there's a lot of angsty grad students listening to you right now feeling really relieved. So I think this is great, sort of see that analysis come to fruition. And it is, I really have to commend you that it is super lucid. And I loved how you justified the case selection. One thing that I want to move on a little bit beyond the national level, more like individual level. So one sentence in your concluding chapter, sorry if I'm like sort of speeding through it, but we'll come back to other parts later on. So one sentence in your concluding chapter that really stuck with me, and I think you already alluded to this, every hour spent organizing is an hour of lost income or rest. So can you walk us through the sort of cost-benefit analysis that goes into your average street vendor's head when they're thinking about the possibility of organizing, and how did this differ, if at all, between the two cases that you've examined?
Yeah, so in the book, I talk about how organizing needs to be worth the time of a street vendor or an informal worker. And street vendors are my cases of informal workers for the qualitative portion of the book. And so the decision to organize needs to give people benefits that outweigh what they would otherwise spend those hours doing. And so the way that people looked at, and I demonstrate in the book with interviews and with participant observation, that the street vendors I was working with really did approach organizing in this cost-benefit way. They talked about the cost, they talked about the benefits, they were very clear that, like, they were going to do this if it was worth it. And if it wasn't worth it, they weren't going to do it. They were going to do something else. And so there was a very big difference in the way that street vendors in Bolivia talked about it versus street vendors in Brazil. And there were also individual level differences. So organizing made sense for some people in Bolivia, but not everyone. And people that it made sense for would talk about how they get benefits, and people that it didn't make sense for would talk about how they didn't get benefits, so they didn't do it. Whereas in Brazil, it made sense for, or it gave benefits to very few people, and very few people organized. So and of course, this is like, I'm not sure what the average street vendor in the world would think. These observations are pulled from the people that I talked to in La Paz and El Alto and Sao Paulo. But what participants told me was that they're working a lot. Like they're often working 8, 10, 12 hours a day to try to make money. A lot of people have kids at home, so they're also trying to take care of kids. They're trying to take care of other family members. They're trying to get enough money to pay their bills. They're cooking. Sometimes they're also like making the things that they're then selling. So like one of the people I worked with, she'd spend like 4 hours a day sewing clothes, and then she spends like 6 hours a day selling those clothes. And then she also had like a disabled child that she was caring for. And so she was just working from like literally 4 a.m. until 10, 11, 12 p.m. every night. And so in that context where people are working a lot, they're only going to take on, you know, these extracurricular activities of organizing, going to union meetings, approaching local government if they're going to get a concrete benefit out of it in a reasonable amount of time, right? And so in Bolivia, that's what people talked about, right? Like, I need to get this cooperation, or I need to have the cooperation of the local government. I need to get this particular document. I need to get this particular thing approved. And so I'm going to join this group. I'm going to do this. I'm going to go to this meeting. I'm going to do this thing with this local bureaucrat. Whereas in Brazil, where bureaucrats refuse to meet with and work with street vendors, people will be like, it is futile for us to try to organize. Like, why would we spend our time doing that? The local government is never going to meet with us. And even if they meet with us, they're never going to actually give us any of these things that we're interested in, which is typically licenses, some kind of security assurances, freedom from police harassment, anything that makes your business more stable and more profitable. And the street vendors in Brazil were like, yeah, that's never going to happen. So why would I waste my time going to these meetings? And so people had these pretty stark cost-benefit analyses depending on their personal situations and then also the local and national political context that they were in and what they could expect from the local government particularly.
Yeah, and I think from your book, it's very clear that the way you've arrived at sort of like understanding how the more macro level works or how it's understood against the backdrop of the micro level is sort of triangulating a lot of different data and analysis techniques. So can you just walk us through your absolutely fascinating data collection plan, because you've leveraged a lot of them. And what I'm curious about specifically is how do they cohere with one another and what sort of purpose do they serve? I understand from the book that it is pretty clean. Each specific data analysis is tailored to a particular point and is answering like a sub question. And at the end of the book, it's sort of like you get the full picture and you understand how these different techniques like cohere with one another, but sort of try to explain it to us. Yeah, maybe also the machine learning, which I tried to explain it to me as if I'm a baby. Maybe, yeah, go ahead. Sorry about that.
Okay, let me do data collection first, and then I'll do analysis second. So because I'm working with informal workers, who I haven't defined informal worker up to this point either. So an informal worker is anyone who is working outside of state-sanctioned labor structure. So it's anyone who is not following local labor regulations, doesn't have the licenses or permits to legally do their job in the place that they're working, and or is not paying into taxes or Social Security or any other of these like state structures that workers are supposed to participate in. So this designates a really heterogeneous group of workers around the world and across different sectors as informal. Street vendors are one of there's a bunch of different like typically informal jobs. Street vendors are one of the canonically informal jobs where like you can have a formal street vendor, but they're pretty rare. I have data on how different types of informal workers organize around the world. Street vendors are kind of right in the middle. So they're a canonical kind of average case to look at. And so because I'm working with people who are by definition outside of the state structures that collect data, my approach to getting data for this project was more data is better, and I'm going to take any possible data that I can get. The other thing with working with informal workers and is that I'm working with people who are breaking all kinds of local and national laws on a regular basis. And so they may not also be super forthcoming with a strange foreign researcher about what they're doing and why they're doing it, because they're doing things that aren't entirely legal. And so because of that, it started with the ethnography, because through ethnography, we can build relationships over time so that people who may not feel comfortable revealing what they're doing to a strange researcher, say in an interview the first time that they meet, may then reveal that information and feel more comfortable once you have a more trusting relationship. And from a political science and research perspective, ethnography can be really, really useful, particularly for things where people have an incentive to hide what they're doing, because you can compare people's words and actions over time. And so you can see if those words and actions are consistent or if there is some slippage in what people are doing and saying. You can also figure out why there's slippage. Is that because they trust you more now, or is it because they understand what they're doing as something different than what they actually than what they're actually doing or what they actually tell you? So that ended up being really, really useful for this project. The ethnographic data showed me pretty much everything that the quantitative data like confirms what I see in the ethnographic data for La Paz and Frau Paulo. But the heart of the project is the ethnographic data, and the like innovative and novel part of the project comes from seeing officials and street vendors interact through the ethnographic stage. So I started with the ethnographic stage, and I spent 12 months collecting data ethnographically, primarily in Bolivia, with a couple of months in Brazil. And so what I did there was I worked as a street vendor, and then I went to lots and lots and lots of meetings within the unions and associations of street vendors, within the like larger federation meetings that brought the unions together, within the individual union meetings, and then also lots of meetings and negotiations between street vendors and bureaucrats at the city level. And then I also did a lot of ride-alongs with police, so that I saw also how street vendors were interacting with the police. And to me, the really interesting thing about that I talk about a lot in the book is that the police in Bolivia like defer to the street vendor organizations to enforce local laws, and so there's not there's a very cooperative relationship between the local police and street vendors, because the police will like notice things, tell the street vendors to enforce it. The street vendors will then enforce things, and then if they need like backup, they'll call the police. They're kind of police light. But there's this very like symbiotic relationship between them, which coming from the United States is quite a surprise. And then this is also very different compared to Brazil, where there's a much more antagonistic relationship that's more similar to the United States, between the military police who patrol markets in Sao Paulo and the street vendors. So I have a lot of ethnographic data from that stage. And then towards the end of that, I also did a lot of interviews with street vendors and bureaucrats, officials, police, to fill out some of that. Excuse me. And then once that was done, I collected data from the Latin American Public Opinion Project, from the comparative study of elections survey, to try to see if we see similar patterns in these large national data sets where we have a bunch of workers responding to a variety of things about what they do and how they interact with the government. And short story, they do. And then I also have some administrative data, which I started trying to get when I was doing the ethnographic field research, and it took me 5 years to get. So I ended up getting it on like a return research trip later, but I also have administrative data from the Bolivian city government. So all of this is to say I have lots of different sources of data in the book, and the principle that governs those sources is just trying to collect as much data as possible, since I'm researching a data scarce topic and population. For any graduate students that listen to this and read the book where it looked neat. It looks like, oh, I have this hypothesis and like I have this data source and I have this. It looked like I planned everything. I absolutely did not.
That's the relief. That's the relief.
There were so many things that went wrong. There were so many sources of data that I thought existed and then they didn't. And so it was very much a just, I'm going to try to get as much data as I can and then see what happens. People should absolutely come up with data collection plans. Now that I'm further along in this, I have data collection plans that do go more smoothly than this particular project did. So you should always start with a data collection plan. But if you're in the field and it goes wrong because the data doesn't exist, you can't get access to this particular person, like keep collecting data, rework the data collection plan, you'll get interesting things. And that's what happened with this project. So the presentation of like, this answers this came after years of scrambling for all that data and then eventually getting enough, not because it like neatly worked out the first time I tried it.
Well, reading through the book, that did not go across at all. But it's really good to sort of like go through the process with you and it really shines through, like the richness of the empirical data really comes across. And one thing that was pretty intriguing to me, specifically about your ethnography, I have to say it caught me a little bit off guard, but in a positive way, is that, and you said it, you worked as an informal tree vendor for some time. I have to say, I went into this book not expecting this at all. And as somebody who does labor ethnography, I was pleasantly surprised and really excited about this detailed. And now I'm going to use this opportunity to ask a couple of maybe self-serving questions. So I'm curious why it was important for you to actually work informally. So I know in the book you said something about there were a couple of instances where the interlocutors asked for something tangible in return for them providing you access. But beyond that, how important was that experience?
So it ended up being really key to the project and how I understood people's incentives and decisions. But it wasn't something that started in the initial research design or in the data collection plan. I did not go into the field planning to work as a street vendor. I for several reasons, one being that I honestly just didn't think about it. It was something that came up while I was in Bolivia. And so I had a bunch of people approach me and like give me job offers. And some of them were people I was working closely with, but a lot of them were people I wasn't working at all. I had multiple people who were like barely acquaintances who owned stalls in a particular market in Bolivia be like, I need someone like you who speaks multiple languages. Like, you're hanging around the markets all the time. Like, would you work for me? And I said no over and over again. And then I started thinking like, hey, it might actually be really useful to do this and see if I get different data and different information. And so one of the street vendors that I was working closely with was like, hey, it'd be really helpful for me if you could work my stall one day a week, because she worked her stall, or she had her stall 7 days a week. It was important to her to sell 7 days a week. Saturdays are the busiest days in the market that she works in, but she was really religious and her church held Saturdays. So Saturdays was the one day that she didn't go to the market. So she was like, it'd be really helpful for me if you could sell for my stall on Saturdays. And you know, maybe it'll help your study. And so I was like, okay, I'll try that and see what happens. And it ended up being really key because it helped me understand all of the very minute things that people have to think of and keep in their head and be aware of while they're selling, and how all of those different considerations influence the decisions they're making about organizing, and then also the things that they need and that are important to them and that they ask for. So I didn't understand how important space in the market was until I was working as a street vendor at the stall, and like the woman next to me was fighting with me over like a tenth of a centimeter. Like it was like the position of the stall, of like one stall leg on this one rock that was like the size of a dime. And I like could not for the life of me see where the limit was, because I was like, it's on the rock. Like, who cared where on the rocket is, the rocket and the size of the dog. But it was really, really important exactly where this stall started and ended, because there were these really big disagreements about exact stall dimensions, because it shapes how much you can sell and how profitable your stall is. And so I didn't understand that dynamic until I worked as a street vendor. And I also didn't understand like the really intense dynamics around space within the market and how intensely regulated that market is by street vendors and by those associations, that people are like, these markets look really chaotic, right? You walk into this market, it looks like chaos, it looks like anarchy. It does not look like anybody is tightly regulating it. But in fact, space is regulated down to a tenth of a centimeter, to the point where it's difficult to see it with your naked eye. And I didn't understand that until I was working as a street vendor. Similarly, after that, and after I like started to learn a lot of things from doing that in Bolivia, when I went back to Brazil, I took one of the people that I've been working with in Brazil before had offered to show me how to be a street vendor in this market in Brazil. And I had said no initially. And then after I had that experience in Bolivia, I was like, yes, I would absolutely love to see this. And so I worked with him for a much shorter period of time, like once or twice a week for 4 weeks, and saw what the incentives and decision-making processes were like for the street vendors in Brazil. And that also really helped, because those street vendors were running from military police on a regular basis. And it was a much different experience to like sit on the side of the market and watch the military police come by versus like the intense adrenaline and fear and anxiety of watching the military police coming down the street and needing to like pack things up and like get out of there so that I didn't lose money and wares for my friends. And so that really hit home, like what some of those dynamics were like and like how antagonistic that relationship was, especially compared to Bolivia. So I'm really glad I did that. And I also highly, highly recommend for anybody doing ethnography that, I mean, of course, it's very dependent on what you're doing, but I'm a big believer of actually doing the activity that you are studying. I think it really helps you learn and embody and viscerally understand the dynamics that you're looking at in a way that observation doesn't quite get you.
I could not agree more. So thank you for that little promo for labor ethnography. I appreciate it. Now, on the opposite spectrum of ethnography is machine learning. So I was fascinated by how you use machine learning to sort of estimate informality, and as you defined it. So the idea is that you have this algorithm that takes individual and country level variables and predicts who works informally and who does not. But as you show in the book, the algorithm does not always get it right and can at times misclassify people. So I wonder if you can walk us through how you went about locating and then rectifying these misclassifications and your frustrations with machine learning throughout the process.
Yeah, so my approach to analyses was similar to my approach to data gathering, which is like, let's try as much as we can and see where it goes. So I mean, that sounds like less rigorous than what I actually did. So I was trying to do analyses that would test different aspects of the theory. And so I started with the workhorse political science one. So there's a bunch of logits in there and other kind of standard statistical regressions on these large public opinion data sets. But there's lots of issues with the data. There's lots of gaps. There's lots of missing data. And so I was looking for a variety of other types of analyses that would try to triangulate these workhorse regression models and maybe account for some of the problems or just the shortcomings of the data. Again, going back to this, that I'm working in an area of data scarcity, and so I don't have like the super high quality, high feature data that I would want doesn't exist. And so I'm trying to triangulate these different data sources and then using different analyses to do that. And so I started doing the machine learning, and I think like I had some friends who were in computer science, and so they were like, try this. And I was like, okay. And so, you know, yay for interdisciplinary friendships. And so I tried the machine learning in a bunch of different ways, and some of them didn't make sense. But what I found the machine learning to be really good for was I had the survey data from like large survey sources, where I had these data sets that had a bunch of people who had answered questions around Social Security that I could use to identify them as informal workers. And then there were questions about like, have you unionized? Do you belong to an association? Do you protest? Have you contacted local officials? And so I could use those questions to identify who in the data set were informal workers, and then what were they doing? How were they mobilizing at work? Who was mobilizing at work? But those questions had only been asked in like 1 or 2 years. And so there's like people from 2006 and 2008 who had answered these questions that I could use to identify informal workers. And then tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who had answered all the other questions in later years, but not the Social Security question because it hadn't been answered. So I used the machine learning algorithm, and specifically what I used was a random forest algorithm to classify who was likely an informal worker in other survey waves. So using all the demographic information that we had to say, okay, well, these are the people that answered the Social Security question. And then these are the people who are really, really similar and probably would have answered the Social Security question in the same way in 2010, 2012, 2014. And it makes sense, right? Like, so for example, you know, I'm going to make up a person, but this is like pretty close to one of the people that was in the data set. There's like a woman in Peru who is a domestic worker in 2006, and she does not make Social Security contributions, and she doesn't organize at work. And so like, I know that that Peruvian woman in 2006 who works in domestic work is an informal domestic worker. But then there's a Peruvian woman in 2012 who is a domestic worker in a different city, and I don't have the question of if she makes Social Security contributions or not. And so what the algorithm does is it says like, okay, how, like, these are all of the people who were informal workers per the Social Security question in 2006. These are all the things that are associated with informal work. How, like, do these people from 2012 then who looks like an informal worker and who doesn't? And so I can create this data set of likely informal workers. As you mentioned, there are shortcomings of this. I can see who in 2006 the algorithm correctly classifies as informal worker or not. I cannot see in 2012 who's correctly classified as informal worker. So I know I have a data set of likely informal workers. I know what the error rate is on the algorithm, but I can't identify in that 2012 data set who is erroneously identified as an informal worker. So there's definitely some error and there's some issues with using it, which is why I use it as like an interesting check on the logistic regressions and like to be another layer of these analyses that I do, but you know, nothing entirely hangs on the error rate of the machine learning algorithm. I will stop there.
Beyond Brazil and Bolivia, I'm wondering what lessons might we draw about informal workers in other parts of the world, and more generally, how is the book relevant for policymaking? So imagine you're talking to an eager, maybe sympathetic bureaucrat. What kind of inferences would you hope they would make having read your book?
Absolutely. So the core argument is that we see informal workers organizing where local bureaucrats, politicians, and not just local, it can also be national too, state officials intervene in their organizing decision by offering them some kind of incentive to organize that they want. In the case of street vendors, it's often licenses. And so we see this in lots of other informal markets, informal sectors, other countries outside of Bolivia and Brazil, where we have varying levels of organizations. And often if we have these really massive organizations like we see in Bolivia, where, you know, 75, 80, in some places, 90% of street vendors belong to these unions, it's typically because local officials are offering some kind of incentive. So one of my favorite examples is India. There's a lot of different informal worker organizations in India. And one of the incentives that officials offer are these like health debit cards. So if you're part of a registered informal worker organization in India, you can get these debit cards that you can use for all different kinds of healthcare expenses. So this is money towards something that people really need, people really want, that they get if they join these organizations. So we absolutely see this happening in other places. The example in India is just one. There's lots of examples from Nigeria, from Uganda, from all over Latin America. And as far as policy recommendations go, what I would say is that local and national officials should be working with informal workers, and they should specifically be working with informal workers organizations, with leaders, with activists, for a variety of reasons. One, there's lots of different programs that policymakers in different places have told me that they want informal workers to participate in. If you want informal workers to participate in these programs, you need to be talking to them, you need to be giving them things that they want, and you need to be talking to their organizations and encouraging those organizations. So for example, if you want informal workers to participate in a tax program, then that tax program needs to offer benefits that informal workers want. And I've seen this in Bolivia, I've seen this in Brazil. When officials work with informal workers and offer them things that they actually want, informal workers flock to those officials, flock to those programs. They will do a lot of the things that you ask them to do. But if you offer them things that they don't want, or if you just kind of set up this program and wait for them to show up, it doesn't happen. And so talk to informal workers, talk to informal worker organizations when you are designing and setting up programs, and set them up with what people want and what people can and cannot do in mind, and not just expect them to come to you later. So there's a bunch of programs that have been set up by different governments for informal workers that have really low enrollment, and a lot of the commonalities in those are that they require informal workers to come with lots of documentation. Informal workers are going to come with lots of documentation. They're informal. That's like one of the hallmarks of the thing. So if, for example, you're trying to get informal workers into a simplified tax regime to just get people paying some level of tax, and you want to distinguish between actual informal workers and say like medium-sized business owners that are just trying to get the simplified tax rate, then don't require all that paperwork from the informal workers. Like, make it your job as the state to do that, to figure out who's a legitimate participant in that program. If you require informal workers to come with all of this paperwork, then you're not going to get informal workers. You're just going to get the like better resourced, better documented medium-sized businesses that are still trying to like kind of cheat the system. Similarly, I've seen all different kinds of programs that offer a lot of things like, say, a simplified tax rate that informal workers don't particularly want or care about, but don't offer things that informal workers do want or care about. So if you are a policymaker who's designing a program, you should be piloting it with informal workers that you're targeting. But some of the common things that people want are licenses, or some other kind of like state protection, money. If you can give people money, they're pretty interested in that. And then often some kind of like healthcare access, money for healthcare, things related to healthcare, because getting adequate healthcare access is a big struggle for lots of informal workers. And then finally, I don't know how far this applies outside of Bolivia, but one of the interesting things in Bolivia is that there's lots of different like national ministries that would set up programs for informal workers, and they would have some kind of incentive that they thought informal workers would want, that the informal workers that I talked to that were part of that program didn't particularly want. What informal workers wanted from that program, and the reason why they signed up, was that they wanted documentation. They wanted documents that would link them to the state, to be like, look, see, I'm participating in this. Like, my small business is legitimated by the state in this way. And then they would use those documents for other things, but they weren't actually participating to get whatever incentive the state was offering. So again, please work with informal workers. Please talk to informal workers. Please pilot things with informal workers. Please work with informal workers organizations, and be sure to design incentives for programs around what people actually want and what also they're able to do.
Whilst also remembering that informal workers are not a monolithic voting group, right? Because that's something that, yeah. So reflect on that a little bit.
So informal workers are not monolithic in lots of ways, which my language probably hasn't reflected very clearly. But there's lots of different types of informal work, and there's also lots of different kinds of people who are doing informal work. So you can have informal work in literally every sector and every job, and we see that, right? Like, we see people working informally in, like, white-collar professional services by not paying taxes, not paying to Social Security, not following laws. And then we see people working, agriculture, domestic work, street vendors, trash collection, transportation are kind of the like canonical informal jobs, but we have lots and lots and lots of other types as well. And then the people who work informally are also very much not a monolith. In many countries around the world, most people are going to work informally at some point in their life, right? Like, I'm a professor from the United States, which is like one of the least informal economies in the world. And like, I've worked informally doing like landscaping and babysitting and like food service under the table. So like, I've worked informally in my career, even in this pretty formal context. And that's pretty common, right? Most people in Bolivia, Brazil, but also Peru, India, Nigeria, Mexico, Indonesia are going to work informally at some point in their career. And we typically see that happening when people are like very early in workers. So people are working as teenagers in their early 20s, and people who are older. So after you've retired from another career, if you're trying to bring in side money, people will be more likely to work informally. Women are more likely to work informally. Gender and sexual minorities are more likely to work informally. Racial and ethnic minorities are more likely to work informally. So anyone who's also more likely to face discrimination in the formal labor market, more likely to work informally. So we have a really heterogeneous group of people. They don't have uniform political preferences at all. Like, some of the people I worked with were like committed Marxists, and some of the people I worked with were like super religious conservatives, and this is in the same place, like this is in La Paz, some of the people I worked with voted for the Green Party. So there's very, very different political preferences across this kind of work as well.
Now that you've said that, I am wondering about your interlocutors, specifically those that you worked with, and whether you were able to share with them your conclusions and your book, and how do they make sense of all of this? And is this convincing to them, the theories that you put forward?
Yeah, so I talk with people who participated in my study throughout the process. And so this is no surprise to them. Like, essentially, I am describing what already happens for them, and they're telling me what already happens. And so the novelty of this project into political science that doesn't expect officials to be encouraging people who are breaking lots of laws to organize and using state resources to organize these unions and associations and encourage these unions and associations. This is not new to the street vendors that I'm working with. They were part of this process, and I presented the project at a couple different stages to the street vendor organizations that I was working with in Bolivia specifically, and so they saw this at different stages. I I did some surveys with them too. And so I like wrote reports on the surveys and gave them to the Street Vendor Federation. And then I also like took my book back and like gave people copies of the book. I've translated the book and hopefully it will come out in Spanish at some point, but like I have the like Spanish PDF of it. So I've been distributing that as well. And so yeah, people are aware of this. As time has gone on, like I've basically stayed in touch with the people I like. So the people I like get along with are the ones that I, you know, see every time I go back to Bolivia and keep talking with about the book project. And the personalities, there were some older men in the organizations that I worked with that I really didn't get along with. And so like I've stopped contacting them as time has gone on. But the people I continue to have relationships with and be in touch with, like, you know, yeah, this reflects what they've experienced and that's what they tell me.
Thank you so much for speaking with me about your book, Why Informal Workers Organize, Contentious Politics, Enforcement, and the State. I really enjoyed this conversation. I enjoyed reading the book even more. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Would you like to add anything before we get off the air?
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about my work with you and also with the audience. So I hope y'all read the book. I hope you like it. Feel free to get in touch. I'm very easily Googleable, and all of my professional contact information is on the internet if you ever want to send me an email with questions.
Fantastic. Thanks again. Bye-bye.